Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, October 7th, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Forgive my voice. I got the flu this week, so I'm recovering, but I sound a little funny. Tonight, Money and Markets, Ask Catherine, and then the third quarter wrap-up. Very important. I like to wrap up at the end of every quarter and the end of the year. And let's go to the movies. I'm going to review Eric Merola's really remarkable documentary, Brzezinski, and touch on Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps, which is the sequel to the movie Wall Street that Oliver Stone did. This one, the sequel also by Oliver Stone. Our theme tonight, can the slow burn continue? We continue to go through what I call the grinding of the gears, which means that there's a fighting for cash flows that necessitates painful institutional challenges and changes. Everyone's fighting for that cash flow. As the cash flow diminishes, the insiders cut the outsiders, and the insiders compete as well. And it's interesting. You hear more and more comments from people who normally I would have thought as insiders saying, this is crazy. Things don't make sense. And that's because as people grab for cash flows and covert events happen that help rearrange cash flows, things that were unthinkable according to custom happen. They're not unthinkable if you look at the algebra, but they are unthinkable if you look at custom. And so the realization of the fragility of the system is working its way through the body politic. Money and Markets, Rasmussen. If you ever doubted that the Americans are a positive group of people, take a look at the new Rasmussen survey, which reports that 61% of American adults in a survey of 1,000 people rate their lives today as good or excellent, with 19% who say their life today is excellent. Just 11% rate their lives today as poor. In May of 2006, 68% gave their lives good or excellent marks. It's election season. Congress left town without extending the Bush tax cuts. Very sensitive and irritating issue. If you look at surveys on the elections, the House is neck and neck for the Republicans to take over. The Senate, according to Rasmussen, their sweep, they show 48 races going to Democrats, 48 going to Republicans, and 4 as a toss-up. Other surveys show the similar ties. So it's incredible. There's no question on the governor races, 30 out of 50 go to the Republicans. The Republicans made a very popular promise before they left town. They came out with their election manifesto, and one of the things they promised was to repeal the health reform law as part of their, if they swept in November. Now, how they're going to deliver that and keep the insurance industry happy, that remains to be seen. If you look at the most important constituency lined up to make sure their cash flow doesn't get cut back too much, it's certainly the insurance industry. One of the most important stories we're watching unfold, it's nothing new to the subscribers of the Solari Report, is the mortgage tornado. We are seeing more and more lawsuits and more problems of servicers who cannot handle reconciling the real world of houses to a world of fraudulent or absent documents. I've talked before many times on why I believe that there are, in many instances, more mortgages, 3 to 10 mortgages per house. But how you reconcile this is going to be a mess. We see reports of people, Bank of America foreclosed on a home that didn't have a mortgage, had been purchased by someone for all cash. We see allegations of servicers being paid to create fraudulent documents so that documents can be available to foreclose. Now we have the court saying that the system, the digital registry system created to track mortgages, does not have the right to request a foreclosure or to be the definitive source of data about who really owns a mortgage. The centralized digital registry called MERS, the MERS system, was created so that literally the Wall Street didn't have to bother to go through the county title offices. And so the county office has it registered with MERS, and MERS is free to transfer it around and then say who owns it. Now, that's being challenged in court, and that could really bring things down. We saw J.P. Morgan Chase and other banks literally stop their whole foreclosure process. So this is going to be a real conundrum, how all this paper gets worked out and reconciled to the real housing stock and who's who. Of course, spending the money and time to really ascertain proper documents on each property is something that the banks are going to be loath to do. We saw, interestingly enough, a spate of alien stories running about UFOs compromising American nuclear weapons situations, and literally saw CNN running the alien stories. One of the reasons I wanted you to hear from Richard Dolan was to make sure you had the best framework on the UFO phenomena that's available. There is tremendous disinformation in this area, and there's a real risk of the misuse of real information. I've always been concerned that when the war on terror sort of ran its course, the next excuse for more centralization would be the theory that aliens exist. So be very skeptical of what you see on that issue, because there's a real opportunity for abuse. There's very good news from the center at Schweinalp, where I was at the Green Phoenix Conference in Switzerland. I spoke to you from Switzerland on Thursday night, and the conference started on Friday. If you go to the events section on our homepage, you'll be able to see the conference agenda. Essentially, what the folks who run the center said is the economy, the world is in real trouble. We need to emerge a new model. We need to get people together from three tracks. One is ecology, one is economy, and one is energy, and bring them together and talk about, okay, well, how do we invent a new model? And the group that was gathered was remarkable. It was a German-centric conference, so most of the speeches were in German. The English translation did not make it onto the DVD, but for those who want to just see the English or plow through the German, if you're literate in German, you can order the DVD from their website. It's really worth seeing. The thing I really enjoyed about it was on one side you had everyone from the agriculture, permaculture, and intentional community side, but you also brought the best and the brightest of a variety of sort of German waste management, recycling, and sort of corporate technology, and incredible entrepreneurs in the area of energy. I have a very good friend who's a physicist named Adam Trombley, who runs the Institute for Studies in Aspen, and it was Adam was one of the sponsors of the conferences, which is how I ended up speaking there. And Adam has a history of working with free energy and is one of the leading experts on free energy. And he had invited people who are real leaders, everything from solar energy to free energy to anti-gravity technology to widgets that optimize your electrical system, as well as people who are working in third world countries at very low cost to do biodigesters in every household. And so whether you're working your way up from human manure and all the way to free energy, you had an incredible spread of technologies which could radically change the cost of energy to households in everything from the third world to the first world. And the thing that was so gratifying to me is typically when I've been with those kinds of technologists, including some of the ones that were there, they were still very interested in working within the system. And yet what happened this time was very different. We had a big meeting after the energy panel, which was the real highlight of the conference. And everybody said, well, you know, what we need to do is just operate. This is guerrilla warfare. We need to operate under the carpet. We just need to introduce this stuff radically in multiple places and just go, 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 and have it spread. We need to do open source, and we need to do a complement of both high-tech and low-tech and just let this multiply and spread out of control. So there was a real guerrilla warfare approach. There was no desire anymore to work with or wait for the system. They understood the extent to which they had been sort of stymied by the system, and they didn't want to waste any more time on that discussion. And if you look at the capability in the room, it was quite astonishing. One of the things you saw in Europe was that there is a tremendous understanding of the fragility of the global financial system and of the American system. I remember being in Europe and in New Zealand and Asia before 2008, and no matter what you said to anybody about what was going on under the carpet, they just really didn't care. America was the Great Oz, and the Great Oz could sort of fix and re-engineer everything and hold it together. And so it didn't really matter if the mortgages were fraudulent, because the Great Oz could make it all work and had the power to do it, and was a something, the Great Oz was to be feared. And the impression you got in from very different kinds of people, from business to finance to the people at the conference, so energy and technology, was that there was no Great Oz. There's just this little man behind the curtain manipulating the machinery. And, and the Great Oz was really sort of a joke. And that's almost a scary, it's sort of a scary situation, because you're almost waiting for the other shoe to drop. What does it now mean that everyone in the world understands how fragile the global financial system is and the American financial system is? What does that mean to how things are going to go? Because it means more and more people are going to be withdrawing from the system. And these are people with significant clout and significant assets. So the realization of, the emperor has no clothes was profoundly serious, profoundly deep, and was a very big change from how things were in 2007. Okay, that's it for Money and Markets. Ask Catherine. Good news. I'm very excited. For a while, we've been searching for a way to add a private blog function to the blog so that we can do more interactive dialogue just with subscribers, so it would be spaces on the blog which are only accessible to subscribers. Anyway, we now believe we can do it. We can put, it'll mean we can put more notes on each report. Hopefully it'll make it easier for you to find segments in the archives and special content for the subscribers. So we're hoping to have it implemented by the end of the year, so stay tuned. If you have any feelings or thoughts on how we might get a private blog space to better serve you, do let us know. Question number one, ask Catherine. Resource Coming Clean Audio mentions your travel. Your travels meeting many groups that were not structuring to be abundant. I keep hearing about systems thinking that nature is the only sustainable economy. My sense is learning the most pure economy is a waste of time. Please expound on what your Hamilton Project determined about multiples of abundance available with return to the community investing. Nonprofit propaganda is effective, I fear. Okay, so really two questions there. One is, what did I learn during the Hamilton, by starting and running Hamilton Securities Group, about where the opportunity is to build a much more abundant economy? And then the second thing is, why is the not-for-profit model as is currently presented not necessarily always the best one? So what's the role of not-for-profits in the mix? At Hamilton, what we did was we were very interested in looking at the total economic performance of all investment within a place. And we were interested in optimizing the value of total equity in a place. Now, let me explain what I mean by total equity. If you own a house and your house has a mortgage, let's say you buy a house for $100,000, You have a mortgage of $80,000. You put $20,000 down. That $20,000 is your equity. So we were trying to optimize the value of the financial equity in a place. And think of a community as a molecule. If the planet is the body, then a community is the is simply a molecule of the planet. So, for example, America's 3,100 counties. If the American economy is going to be healthy, you need 3,100 counties' economy to be healthy. So what we were concerned with was how do you optimize it? And here are some simple rules of thumb of what we discovered. The first thing we discovered was that the return on government investment was negative. So what was happening was government was investing money in places, and by investing I mean they were spending money in the form of purchases or contracts or government programs. And that money was being invested in a way that made the economy less productive. So, for example, when you pay a person to be in a welfare program, we found, for example, that the average woman in Washington with 1.8 children in HUD-assisted housing on food stamps was costing U.S. taxpayers $55,000 a year. Now, what was interesting is $25,000 would train that woman to do a data servicing job where she would earn $20,000 to $25,000, pay taxes, so she could go to be somebody who would pay $5,000 a year of taxes instead of require $55,000 of expenses. That's a $60,000 swing. Anyway, but you would pay her to not work, and in the process it turned out she used approximately 35 hours a week just to deal with the bureaucracy of managing her benefits within the program. So it was extremely time-consuming for her to be on government subsidies, but she was learning how to do something that wasn't very productive. If you read my Dylan Reed story, I talk about how literally with the prison bulge, you take somebody who's costing us $55,000 and move them to somebody who costs us more than $154,000 a year. So, you know, a leap in lack of productivity. But essentially you're paying someone to do something that makes them stupider. And when I first got to HUD as Assistant Secretary of Housing, I discovered that when a lot of the programs started, the subsidy programs into communities started, that literally 70 cents on the dollar went to somebody in a community, whereas by the time I got there, my estimate was 27 cents went to somebody in a community. Well, where did it go? It went to this unbelievably paperful, bureaucratic group of state and local government and corporations, private real estate developers, and all sorts of not-for-profits. I'll give you a perfect example. One time I was sitting with the Washington office at HUD, and they needed people to tutor the young people in the neighborhood. And I said, well, wait a minute, you've got all these well-educated elders, particularly in the churches in this neighborhood. It's a neighborhood with wonderful churches. And I said, you know, those are people the kids will trust, and they, trust is so important for learning speed. Why don't we have them do it? Well, they would have none of it. They wanted to spend $1 million for a contract to George, I believe it was Georgetown University, it might have been George Washington. Well, the whole thing was being organized so that the big university could get $1 million contract, when in fact there was a volunteer solution in the neighborhood that was much more effective or could have been done much cheaper. It's a perfect example, but you've created these unbelievably expensive layers of intermediaries. Another example I always tell is the neighborhoods where we used to always find you could rehab and you could buy and rehab an FHA foreclosed property for $50,000, but meantime HUD was spending $250,000 per unit to reconstruct or build public housing. And during the Clinton administration, I went to the assistant of the person who ran that program, and I said, Mindy, look, we could build, you know, five homes for the price of one. She turned beet red and said, but how would we generate fees for our friends? well, we've had 50 years of fees for our friends. So anyway, but if you look at any county in America, what you'll find is the government investment has a negative return on investment, and unfortunately, that's we've built up powerful political constituencies for that negative return on investment. Any change to how those programs are run is going to set, Lord knows, everybody you know, including all of us, into an uproar. At the same time, there's incredible opportunity to change that. And that's why you want to look at optimizing the equity, because the issue then becomes, if we change the negative return on investment to a positive, who's going to get the increase in equity? And that's part of the debate around doing it. Now, if you look at the equity, you've got a mixed bag. One of the most productive groups in a small place is small business, but they have suffered under, you know, a whole lot of struggles. A lot of the government negative return comes about by sort of supporting corporations moving in and sort of taking over franchises, taking over the neighborhood. At the same time, corporations are mixed bag. They can be remarkably productive at some things. A lot of those intermediaries include not-for-profits. And it's very important when you look at the role of not-for-profits that you look at them in focused on functions where not-for-profits are very important. For example, education is an area where the not-for-profit model works very well. And you'll see throughout the economy, one of the ways the tapeworm is so effective is that they're very effective at using for-profit and not-for-profit in very productive ways. So they'll use the not-for-profit in education, and then they'll use the for-profit in the areas that can be run very profitably on a for-profit basis. So there are many ways a not-for-profit can work well. The problem you have is that not-for-profits are often used to keep the equity in a place from going into the hands of the small businesses, and I'll give you an example. When we were working on community venture funds in Norfolk, Virginia, and were encouraged to stop in 1998 as a result of our litigation with the federal government, I had lunch with the general counsel to the chairman of the subcommittee in the House of Representatives that oversees community development, and he said, here's how it's going to work. He said, the only equity that is going to go into any of these communities is through not-for-profits who do tax credit investment, which is a particular kind of tax credit investment that at the time was benefiting Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and a few large corporations. And he said, but essentially the only people who will own real estate equity in these neighborhoods with our help is going to be not-for-profits. And basically what he's saying is private families in these communities will not be allowed to build wealth. Well, the basis of freedom and the basis of healthy economy is families that build intergenerational wealth. And if you shut off that mechanism, then you shut off the ability for people to rise. Anyway, so you want to be careful when you use not-for-profits that they're there to build human and intellectual capital, but not shut people out of a pathway to build financial equity. Anyway, more on that later, because as I'll talk about in a second, I think we're going to see more with community venture in 2011. Another question, say the dollar loses its reserve status or the market crashes and loses half its value and silver and gold soar to unbelievable heights. And if we then wanted to sell, what would we buy? Not dollars. Most currencies would collapse. So what? Goods, property? Okay, so I hate to be redundant, I hope you'll forgive me if I am. Once upon a time, we used to use our capital to buy the strategic resources we needed. So we bought land so we could grow food. We bought land so we could have water. We bought horses and cows so we could have transportation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So then we shifted to a model where we said, okay, well, we're going to put all of our money, instead of buying the things or buying the assets that produce what we need. We'll simply put our money in financial assets, get a dividend, turn around and use the dividend to buy all this stuff at the store. You know, we'll buy a car, we'll just pick up the food at the store. And that's called intermediation. We've allowed corporations to intermediate us. So we put our money in corporate stocks and bonds, and then we get a dividend, and then we go to the corporate store, and we buy our goods and services from the other side of the corporation's balance sheet, so to speak. Now what we're looking to do, and every person is different. So if you're in your 80s and you live in Queens, it's very different than if you're young and strong and you live in, you know, rural Vermont. But now what we're looking to do is anything we can do to disintermediate is good. So the more we can organize with those around us and buy directly or invest directly in the strategic resources we need to provide what we need so that we don't have to go through a system that may or may not be reliable, the better off we are. And I always tell the story of my friend who was complaining that the yields on her stock were dropping and or her water bill was going up. She lived in a rural area. I said, this is really easy. Just sell your stock and build a well, which is exactly what she did. Okay, ideas for helping our communities through collapse. I have brainstormed on helping my state to navigate the complete collapse of our system. It would be helpful to develop contingency plans and share ideas. In my opinion, the states with the best foresight, communication, plan, and resources will come out the other end in better shape. Anyone want to join this effort? I've not presented my ideas to my state government, but would love to formulate a plan to slap on the desk when the time comes. I would really encourage you to think in terms not of your state, but of your county. If I'm a state administrator or a state legislator, I'm going to want to know what the sheriff of the counties in my legislative area or the first responders in the counties that I represent, what they think. So if you can work a plan through or figure out how to get to know and support your sheriffs and the county first responders and 9/11 teams with such a plan, that's, you know, you come up with material that then that can start to spread virally because you've worked it through the constituencies in your home base who are going to be respected both virally across the state and up into the state government. So I wouldn't go direct into the state. I'd work first with find out how you can give energy to the people around you. And remember, there's nothing that's going to be more important. The guy who's sovereign in these situations is your local sheriff. So if you haven't listened to our audio seminar with Richard Mack on who's your sheriff, you really want to listen to it. Another question, time has gone by. Are there any social media places besides this blog where people interested in finding a Solari Circle can search by economic interest or geography? Is Solari.com going to have such a tool? We've tried to have online forums before and had not a lot of success with them. What we've ended up with is sort of a lot of people sabotaging and causing trouble, a lot of troublemakers. One of the things that most concerns me about Facebook is that never happens on Facebook, which says a thing or two about the extent to which they're protected. Anyway, but I'm hoping this blog will help people find each other and get together if they want to. I really encourage you that it's important to go through a chain of people you know and trust, so the more that you can network this personally, the better. But again, I hope the blog can make some difference. Okay, third quarter wrap-up. Well, I don't know where to start. There's so much to say. Currency debasement wars. The strong dollar policy has now been converted to the weak dollar policy. Who ever thought we would live to see the day? When we were exporting our capital for investment, we wanted the dollar high, so we wanted, you know, Korea's currency to be low and ours to be high because then we could buy their equity cheap. Now that we want to export, now that we've exported all our capital and bought all of them cheap, we want to reverse it. We want our dollar low and their currency high One, because we want the yields coming back to be high, but also we want to export more goods. There's a real push to try and help employment. Not that I think it's going to do a lot of good, but we see Geithner giving a speech yesterday, laying out his agenda for the next round of G20 meetings, and talking about the importance of basically our currency being low and their currency being high. Now, if you were the world and felt you'd been whipsawed, you'd be right. One of the things that came out in my meetings in Europe is that there is really a wild card in Germany, and I saw this at the conference, which is, again, was German-centric. The Germans were not foolish enough to export all their manufacturing to Asia. They still maintain a very significant manufacturing base in Germany. They're exceptional at technology and engineering. There are those who argue one of the reasons we saw the war to the bitter end in World War II is we couldn't afford for a strong Germany to emerge. They're a formidable economic competitor. The report from Europe is that the Germans are, as a people, deeply irritated at the bailout of Greece. Now, of course, the bailout was not of the Greek people, but of the banks that went into Greece and did what they did. But there was real indication that the Germans may not go along with more rounds of bailout, and that that sort of leash may be a short one for the German politicians. But it's very interesting, and if the Germans pull out of the euro, then you've got a real interesting moment in this sort of this race to debase in the currencies. Interestingly enough, I never thought I'd live to see the day. Project Censored at Sonoma, forget the exact name, but the community college in Sonoma, is a group that I have tremendous respect for. Peter Phillips, who runs Project Censor, has for many years, gets a large group of students to run a process to sort of identify, list, and write up the most important censored stories of the year. They just published their new book for 2011, What's the Number One Story? The Plans to Replace the Dollar as the Reserve Currency. Wow. So that really brings currency to another level in the popular consciousness. I mean, we're literally getting to the point where teenagers discuss and talk about currency. Everybody in Switzerland at the conference wanted to talk about currency. It was quite interesting. One of the reports from a wonderful intentional community in Portugal, they've now been asked by the mayor in their town to help, because if you look at the extent to which the community is being drained by currency debasement, they said they now have older people going hungry, and it's getting very, very serious. Okay, one of the biggest developments in the third quarter. I think it will be a quiet one in the fourth quarter, but very important next year, is what's happening with the discussion of IRAs and 401ks. Now, for those of you who have been subscribers for a while, you know that we've followed this, particularly on the precious metals report. It's an issue of great concern to Franklin and me, also because we get asked a lot about the confiscation with respect to precious metals, but that always takes us into 401ks and IRAs. I want to read you something I wrote this week about 401ks and IRAs, because I've been thinking about this quite a lot. I've been talking with you about it, but I wanted to bring this down to a number, so here it is. After much research and contemplation of both the international and national political and economic situation, including the U.S. on budget debt and contingent liabilities, I've come to the conclusion that the odds of legislation in 2011 regarding IRAs that I would describe as confiscatory are high. I also believe that the tax rates will rise in 2011 as well. Currently, I give the odds of confiscatory policies going into effect by the end of 2012 to be 95%. The most likely policy is the one that converts withdrawals to annuities that may not be assigned to children at death. Restrictions over time on assignment to spouses are not out of the question. I give the odds of legislation in 2011 that implements such policies to be 80%, including the creation of dates that subject funds and IRAs at that time to such provisions. I also expect an effort to mandate 401k or other retirement plans by small business during this period. I've not yet put a probability estimate on this proposal. I also expect tax rates in the top bracket to rise in 2011 beyond. My conclusion is that the net present value of tax benefits of staying in an IRA are now less than the net present value of the losses that will result from the changes in policies. Now, that said, each person's situation is different, and so what each person should do or when it is most economic to withdraw, if that is what you decide to do, depends a lot on individual and unique circumstance. The reason I bring this up now is that now is this time to start thinking about it. Nothing will happen before the election, particularly because the Republicans are in the catbird seat. They're looking to small business to return them to control the House, possibly the Senate. The last thing they're going to do is basically throw a stake into the heart of small business by messing with this before the election. If the Republicans do win, it could delay legislation into 2012 from 2011. But if you look at the U.S. debt clock and the algebra of the numbers, this is coming, and I think it's coming reasonably fast. And I really want you to look at this from the point of view of the person who is making the decisions. Pretend for a second that you are the President of the United States, the Secretary of the Treasury, the Federal Reserve Chairman, and, you know, the 10 people who most pull their string, and you're sitting in a room and you want to continue to finance the payment of Social Security, what do? Well, you can print money, you can abrogate the Social Security benefits, you can abrogate the public debt or the interest thereon, or you can stop paying the military. Now, what are you going to do? Well, you can also require the people who you owe the Social Security benefits to let you use their retirement savings to finance them, which is pretty logical because the money's coming to them. One of the things that was very interesting in Europe was I had the opportunity to talk to somebody who had spent time in the European Union legislature. And what he described to me was very similar to what we're seeing today, which is in the United States, which is lots of different ways of literally moving assets out of retirement arrangements or basically draining pension funds and retirements and moving phony baloney paper back in. And so what's happening here in the things I've been telling you with respect to the mortgage market and the pension funds is happening very much there. So you see the same picture. You see an aging baby boomer population who thinks they have all these incredible benefits. They don't realize the extent to which these benefits have been drained, are being drained, or have sort of shaky paper behind them. In the meantime, the economy is in sort of this negative return on investment downward because the resources are being allocated in a political fashion as opposed to a fashion that would optimize learning speed or human capital or any sort of economic allocation designed to build the economy, build, as I said before in the question to Catherine, a more abundant economy. And you have then this political class that's very intransigent and really doesn't know another way. It really doesn't know another way. And so what exactly is going to happen when the boomers realize the money's not there? Well, of course, what's everybody want to do? They want to play kick the can. So if back to you sitting in this decision room, you're all these people, you're Mr. Global in one head, what would you do? Well, the easiest thing to do is just take $7 trillion of 401k money and IRA money and find ways to start channeling it to help you keep the game going for another couple of years. So this question is going to be upon us with force after the election. And so now is the time to start thinking about what you want to do. Normally, this would be a 2011 decision for those of you who are going to see your tax rate kicked up, particularly at the top next year, and that's relevant to this decision. You might want to start thinking about it this year. Okay. Gulf oil spill. The Gulf oil spill was probably one of the most significant events of this year. It was certainly a wild card. No one thought that this kind of ecological damage could happen, particularly to the southern states, which have been a real economic engine in this recession, despite everything. And this really was an extraordinary, an extraordinary blow to the vitality of the culture, of the life, and of the small business, because we're talking about a source of food that is a gift from, it's a gift from the earth every year. And a lot of that gift goes to the hands of sole proprietors or small business people or small restaurants or, and it's such an important part of the life. You know, I remember going to see my uncle in Charleston, and they used to just take a net out into the back of the marsh behind their house and come back with enough shrimp for 10 people for a whole dinner. And we'd have shrimp cocktail, and nobody'd ever get to dinner, because, and it was the most delicious shrimp you'd ever want to have. So you're talking about something which is so much part of the life. I just had some recent emails from Ricky Ott, who we had on the Solari Report. And the reports of death and dying and sickness are just astonishing. She's covering them on her blog, and we'll continue to cover them if you're interested. But I was stunned the first night that I got to Zurich. We went to the Zurich Opera and then went to a lovely, lovely restaurant for dinner. I was with two friends, and my friends started to order and then insisted on the waiter giving him very detailed information about where the seafood was from before he would order the seafood. And then he turned to me afterwards and told me this very chilling story of a fairly famous American who had eaten seafood in a restaurant in Chicago, got wildly ill. It was considered to be from the dispersant, and they were really wondering if he would ever completely regain his mental function. It was a chilling, chilling story. But there are real reports of safety issues with the food, so I want you to be very, very careful. And you should assume, I think, we're in a world where if you don't know for a fact that seafood is safe, you may want to assume that it's not, unfortunately. I still continue to think that we don't know the true story of what happened, and the chances that this was initially part of the oil card theory of Jim Norman, an effort to keep the price of oil up, is a very real possibility. The reality is the people involved would do that. Whether they would do it, among other things, to rein this kind of ecological damage on the world, that's a whole other question. But needless to say, the Gulf oil spill, we haven't begun to see the ramifications yet. It's going to take a long, long time to watch them all play out. Reform during the last year was a very ugly word. Healthcare reform, food reform, internet reform. Healthcare reform passed. Food and internet reform has not yet passed. That's why it's very important that you get out and make sure your congressman knows what you think of all these things and send them back in there, hopefully, to do the right thing. It was very interesting to see the Republicans promise in their manifesto that they would reverse healthcare reform. Again, how they do that up against the insurance lobby beats me, but it will be interesting to see them try. I question whether they're sincere in their effort. Energy technology, is it time for it to come out of the closet? I cannot tell you how wonderful it was to be in a room in Switzerland with many, many brilliant scientists, inventors, energy technology engineers who were talking and excited and successful at bringing these kinds of technologies to our issues. I'm a person who loves technology, and I think bringing the very best of the land and permaculture and agriculture and combining it with everything that technology can do in a way that is aligned and harmonious is that which brings us, among other things, the most productive economy that we can create. And so I think, you know, I believe in a successful marriage of high tech and low tech. And it's clear from watching that we need those kinds of technologies and corporate skills to do it. And so, the time is come to bring those groups together, and I compliment the center in Switzerland for doing it. It absolutely needs to happen. One of our subscribers has been writing me and saying, you know, I think the Black Budget Boys are leaving the Bilderbergers behind. And in situation after situation, we're watching sort of a new, younger, meaner group. And I would include Cheney as an example of that group. Basically, sort of leaving the old boys behind and moving very quickly. And it's what Richard Dolan called the breakaway civilization. And I think one of the things we need to be prepared for is after the election, I asked the question, can the slow burn continue? The answer is absolutely yes, I think it can. But things are going to have to get meaner. And if the breakaway civilization is in control, it's going to get a lot meaner a lot faster. And that's why kooky things, I mean, I can't tell you how many people, if I told them today what I believe is going to happen in 2011 and 2012, with respect to 401ks and IRAs, would say that's impossible. That's politically impossible. It's just nuts. You have no basis for thinking that. But if you look at the algebra and the politics at the top, it makes all the sense in the world. And I think part of it is because the breakaway civilization is moving fast and putting lots of pressure on the machinery. Okay, so let's look at some of the sort of sectors that you're dealing with day to day. Unemployment, there's no end game in sight. I don't care how far down they bring the dollar. We're in for long-term structural unemployment unless we start to unsuppress energy and healthcare technology or have a revolution in how we finance communities. We let community venture funds happen and stop kicking small business into the ground, and a lot can happen. But otherwise, please don't wait. If you're unemployed, please don't wait for employment. Get to work as much as possible, as quickly as possible, doing things to lower your expenses, and help the people around you on the things they ask for help. If you just keep doing that, it's going to turn into a paying job. You don't need a job. You need 20 different sources of income that add up to something attractive. Housing and real estate markets, things are getting really dicey. I don't care what the yield is. Please stay away from mortgage paper. The squabbles that we're going to have to go through in the next year and a half are tough. On real estate, be very careful. All real estate is local, but this market has more to fall. Given the speed at which the central bank is printing, that may hold nominal prices, but the market has more to fall. Anyway, be very careful. One of the things you're seeing in the municipal markets, again, another market to be careful in, is talk about holding up cash flows. I know if I mentioned this before, but I want you to keep watching this. One of the ways to bolster municipal credits is to take private cash flows, i.e. the drug business, and just move it over into the legalized category. Everybody can use the sales taxes. So we're watching drug reform used as the latest mechanism to bolster municipal credits. Equity markets, the shift to the emerging markets not only continues but is exploding. I had a chart up on the blog last week that showed the new bulge moving to the emerging markets. You see that not just in the equity markets but the bond markets too, and it's very interesting. If you look at the yields on the emerging bond funds, the bonds are rated much lower than on the first world bond funds. At the same time, when you realize that equity is growing and money and liquidity is moving into those markets, those ratings are probably too low for what's really going on the higher graded ones. They're probably too high, but the shift in the emerging market is accelerating. Now, a big correction should be upon us. If you look at the equity charts for some time, there are a lot who've expected a big correction. It hasn't happened. Instead, we're getting a run-up, same as with precious metals. Some of that is the fact that the central banks are printing as part of this sort of debasement rate race in the currency. But at the same time, with very low interest rates getting lower, how we can maintain this kind of interest rate level is going to be interesting to see. Okay, sovereign debt wars are going to continue. We've seen the euro appreciate a lot against the dollar, but we have some real sovereign debt problems to face coming into the next 4 to 6 months. In Europe, we saw a conference call with Ireland, literally catcalls by investors to the Irish finance minister. Very, very kind of scary. A perfect example of the breakdown in respect. Commodities and precious metals up, up, and away. We're going to talk a lot more about precious metals next week with Franklin Sanders. My prediction for the year is a high of 1350. Franklin's been 1375. We're getting awfully close, and given that December has been the high point for gold for the last 5 out of 10 years, the market may prove us both too conservative. Wouldn't surprise me. Finally, can the slow burn continue? I spent a lot of time in Europe and on my way back from Europe thinking about whether or not I wanted to change my odds on the slow burn. I started the year at 80-20, 80% chance we slow burn through 2010. I changed that later in the year to 70%. I gave some real consideration to changing it to 65%, and I'll tell you why. There was a group of people that I met with and spoke who are very nervous about the breakdown in the leadership, people in the leadership getting out of the United States, shifting their money out, afraid of breakdown, et cetera, et cetera. And what I have described to you is what I call the Minionite thing, really worried about fighting among the leadership and the inability of the leadership to sort of hold the line. And they didn't describe the breakaway civilization as the breakaway civilization, but I think that's part of the phenomena they were describing. After giving it a lot of consideration, the reality is the leadership absolutely has the tools they need to continue to maintain the slow burn. The only thing that could reduce the possibility of doing so is the inability to cooperate. The debasement wars could do it. I mean, what we're looking at is the 2010 version of the trade wars of the 1930s. If those got out of hand, and they could, and that's why what I described about the lack of respect is so dangerous, because that lack of respect is like blood in the water to the sharks. So with the investors not respecting the governments and the governments not respecting each other, it's not a pretty picture. The reality is we can keep the slow burn going, but it means, again, as I've said every time, things will turn meaner. So after the election, particularly after the new Congress comes in January 20th next year, look for more wars, more violence, more crazy stuff, and things like policies to change our IRAs and 401ks. So no change to the odds of the slow burn, but watch for sort of meaner and more dangerous things to keep the slow burn going. Okay, heroes and opportunities. Oh, one little tidbit before I go to heroes and opportunities. A new service is maybe of interest to some of you. I'm always getting questions about how do I move my money out of the country. Go take a look at a website called DASSAFE, DASSAFE.com. It's in Vienna. You get a box with a number and a key. You don't have to leave your name. You pay your rent forward. You put whatever you put in the box. And as long as you don't lose your number and your key, you come back and get it whenever you want. Seemed to me a pretty clean way of having a deposit box offshore. You can apparently leave your name if you want to. So if you're worried you might lose your number and a key, then leave your name. Okay, heroes and opportunities for the quarter. The people of Iceland are definitely, the people of Iceland do not only do not take being sort of worked over in shock doctrine lying down, but they come back with verve and creativity and a great sort of esprit de corps. And we've talked about many of the different things they've done, from the new political party that uses Tina Turner songs as their party song, to efforts at global transparency and trying to hold the former prime minister legally accountable, which I just love. But clearly these are people who believe in democracy and practice it, so they are an inspiration to us all. Another group I want to mention is 9/11 Truthers. The 9/11 Truthers just never quit. And the funny thing is there's so much profound evidence on 9/11 that the official story is a bunch of hooey. And you've now got incredible scientists, incredible architects. You've got all sorts of video. There's a new video just made available of two firemen being interviewed and some first responders being interviewed. I just put it up on the blog. But you just have to give these people credit that they just never quit. I would have just given up a long time ago. It's so negative. Anyway, but they've done a remarkable job, and I just got David Ray Griffiths, who's my favorite 9/11 writer, just came out with a new book that just castigates Cass Sunstein, I think that's his name, of the current administration, who was proposing a plan to sort of sabotage 9/11 truthers. Anyway, I haven't read it, but it looks delicious. Anyway, but these guys have formidable ability and intellectual clout. How they do what they do, I don't know, but I got to give them credit. They're real heroes. So that's it for the quarter, the people of Iceland and 9/11 truthers. Finally, opportunity, community venture funds. In 1990 at Hamilton, I was prototyping community venture funds. I went and spoke in Michigan last month and then in Switzerland again, and discovered just an enormous appetite for community venture funds. So I've been working on a kit on how to do a Solaris Circle. I'm going to put that on hold and try and write in the next month a paper on community venture funds to start that discussion as well. They're really two sides of the same coin. And I hope to do a Solaris report on community venture funds and make those documents available to subscribers before the end of the year. It's worth taking a look at. I'm going to post on the blog some of the old links. It's worth thinking about because I think there's tremendous opportunity, and there's enough interest now in different parts of the world that I see the possibility for some real grassroots. What we need is a lot of places trying things at the same time so that nobody, this is sort of happening everywhere at the same time. It's more ubiquitous. Okay, let's go to the movies very quickly. Eric Marola's remarkable documentary, I cannot recommend it to you enough, Brzezinski, on the wonderful doctor Stanislaw Brzezinski, who practices in Texas and has a remarkable history of healing people from very difficult cancers, particularly brain tumors. It's an amazing indictment of the U.S. healthcare system. If you want to understand why U.S. health reform is not reform, and want to understand why our healthcare costs are so out of control, I can't think of a better documentary to do it. It's just really, really remarkable. You can link to the website and the blog where you can buy it. I don't know if Netflix has it yet, but I hope they will get it. I also wanted to comment on Oliver Stone's sequel to Wall Street, Wall Street Money Never Sleeps. In Wall Street Money Never Sleeps, Jacob Moore plays the fiancé of Gordon Gekko, old hero from the first movie, played by Michael Douglas. He's engaged to Gordon Gekko's daughter, Winnie. Well, one thing leads to another, and Gordon Gekko gets out of jail and persuades his daughter, with Jacob's help, to turn over the money he squirreled away in Switzerland, $100 million to him. Gekko takes off with the money, and rather than sending it back for investment in an energy company that can really solve the energy problems of the world, he instead starts to manage it and make much money on it as a hedge fund. And the big issue in the movie is, are we just going to keep churning money in a paper game, or are we going to start to invest in things that build a real future for the humans? And it's, in many respects, it's a terrible movie. I don't recommend it, but it asks the most important question, and it does it in a very interesting way. At one point, Jacob discovers that his boss has persuaded the Chinese to put $100 million into a solar company that's going no place, because essentially that won't in any way impair the boss's investments in oil companies and sort of traditional fossil fuel technologies. And you see all the debate about, well, wait a minute, are we just going to keep destroying the real economy, or are we going to invest to build a real economy? And Gordon Gekko's daughter becomes pregnant, and the real question faced by Gordon Gekko, is he going to put his money behind what's good for his grandson to be, or is he going to put his money just chasing around in the paper game? And it, you know, it asks the real question, because that's what we're doing. We're spending our money, we're investing our money to really destroy the real economy, but nobody wants to move out of the game because they're making money playing the paper game. Anyway, there it is. In closing, next week, Precious Metals Market Report. We're publishing a special Solari report in time for next week's. Some of you wanted a lot more detail on the annuity proposal, so I wanted to prepare something that would provide you with lots of links to the different ones that have been considered, so you can look at the detail to your heart's content. The following week, wonderful certified nutritional therapist, neurobiofeedback specialist Nora Gidgadis on Primal Mind, Primal Body. Also remember, we want to help you with Solari, Silver, and Gold. You can call and talk to David Lichty, Paul Ferguson, or myself. It's official. We're now on the GATA roll call of precious metal dealers. Our new podcast, number 16, is out. Recommended. We've got Dr. Lustig and the report from Switzerland both on it, and Franklin Sanders on the creation of the Federal Reserve. So until next week, ladies and gentlemen, when we talk about this incredible run-up in the precious metals market, this has been the third quarter report. Thank you for joining us on the Solari report. Remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.